This is the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, February 14th, St. Valentine's Day. Here at CAI, we'd love to discuss the week's top local stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. We'll speak with Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette, Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle, and Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. We'll check in with Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current and Kevin G. Andrade of the New Bedford Light. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. Commuter rail service to the South Coast is almost ready to start up. The Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority, the MBTA, says it will be ready to carry passengers from New Bedford and Fall River to Boston on March 24th, but only if South Coast Rail gets a final safety approval. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here to talk about that, and she'll share her reporting this week about how the Trump administration's hiring freeze could affect the Cape Cod National Seashore. Hi, Jeanette. Do we have you there, Jeanette?
Yes, we do.
Thank you. First, South Coast Rail. The region has been waiting for this service since the state first started talking about it in the 1980s. So, like, before there was an internet. Now it's almost here. Tell us what it will be like for riders and how often the trains will run. What are some of those details?
Sure. The exact times of the trains are supposed to be released in early March, but we do know a lot about the schedule already. Weekday trains will run from about 4:30 in the morning until about 1 a.m. On those weekdays, there is a train about every 70 minutes.
I think we may have just lost Jeanette Barnes there. We're going to try to get her back on the line now. I'm going to take a moment, and I think we'll switch seats here. And I'll invite Eve Zukoff to join us. She's sitting right here in the studio, CAI's Eve Zukoff. Let's go over to Eve for a moment. Hey, Eve, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Steve. I'm sorry I had to sabotage Jeanette. I was so excited to talk to you.
Let's see. Wait, Dan Treadle, give me the cue, what I'm looking at there. Okay, I just got the word in my earpiece that Jeanette Barnes is back with us.
Ugh.
Eve, sit tight just for one more minute.
Okay,
we'll get to you, too. I
want to
talk about South Coast Rail. Jeanette, sorry we lost you right there. You're going to tell us what are some of the details about how often the trains will run. This is all geared to start up March 24th.
Right, so there is a train about every 70 minutes, but it is a New Bedford train or a Fall River train, not both during that time frame. So to help with that lag, in between trains to each city, they're planning to offer a shuttle. So if you're in one city, but the train is leaving from the other city, you can meet that train where the two lines converge in East Taunton. There are six new stations along South Coast Rail. You've got Fall River and Freetown on one branch and two New Bedford stations on the other branch. And then, as I said, when they move north, they converge in East Taunton at one station, and then there's a new Middleborough station as well as you head north. All of these stations are in fare zone 8, so that means fare is $12.25 one way on weekdays. On weekends, though, they do have a $10 pass, which is unlimited rides for both days.
Tell us a bit about how this shuttle is going to work that's connecting if you're coming down from Boston.
Sure. I think, you know, most people, when they hear the word shuttle, they're thinking of like a minibus. This is not that. This is a train. But the shuttle train is one that only moves locally between the fork in the rail line at East Taunton and the end of the two lines, New Bedford and Fall River. And it works whether you're heading north or south. So, like, let's say you're in Boston and you're trying to get home to New Bedford, but the next train goes to Fall River. Well, instead of waiting a really long time for the next one that goes to New Bedford, you could get on in Boston onto the Fall River train, get off in East Taunton, and then a local shuttle train would be meeting you there to take you down to New Bedford.
We know that South Coast Rail has been delayed a number of times. Now it still needs a final sign-off from the federal government. With everything happening in Washington right now, that seems like perhaps a recipe for uncertainty. What is that sign-off, and does the MBTA anticipate any trouble with that?
It is from the Federal Railroad Administration, and I know that at a minimum, it involves a final safety certification. And one thing that the MBTA has to do in order to get that is what's known as the run of service, which is basically like a dry run of the full train schedule as if it had passengers on it. To date, they've done a bunch of test runs, but this is the full schedule. So, yes, it is hard to say if everything going on in Washington will delay that at all. And they were asked that the other night at a public meeting. But the MBTA says they don't expect a problem because they've been working with this agency, the Federal Railroad Administration, for several years now on this project. And in the last year or so, they've been meeting in person every month. They say that those train officials from D.C. actually come up to see what they're doing with the new South Coast Rail territory, and they're getting positive feedback.
I'm wondering about the Cape Flyer. That's our summer rail service to the Cape. Is South Coast Rail going to change that?
No, the Cape Flyer in the summertime is not affected by this. It will continue to stop at the old Middleborough Lakeville station on its way to the Cape, which is what it does in previous, what it did in previous summers. But the name of that station where it stops is now just going to be Lakeville. The station actually is in Lakeville, just over the Middleborough line. It always has been. So, but now there are going to be two separate ones. Middleborough, the new Middleborough station is on South Coast Rail. The Lakeville station, not South Coast Rail, but that's the one, the Lakeville station is the one that's sort of where the tracks begin to head southeast for the Cape Flyer.
This week, you covered a community meeting hosted by the MBTA. It was in Freetown. It was about this project. They were explaining all the details. It was a chance for people to come out and hear about them. I'm curious, what did people in the audience have to say?
Well, several people said they were thankful to have this service after so many years, and they asked a variety of questions. I will say that the people who were happy about the train tended to identify themselves as living in towns other than Freetown, where the meeting was held. They were from places like Fall River, New Bedford, and even farther afield from that. Two people from Freetown in the audience did talk about the noise that they've experienced during the testing of the trains, and that is not going to get any better with the actual operation of the trains. Part of that is because the noise is most noticeable if you live near a road crossing of the train. Trains legally have to blow the horn four times when they approach a crossing. So there was a man there, Billy Guay, who's a Freetown resident, lives near a crossing. He says the noise is too much and he'd like to move, but he's afraid now he won't be able to sell his house.
Let's talk about your story on the national parks in light of the federal hiring freeze. What did you learn about how this could affect the Cape Cod National Seashore as you looked at this week?
Yes, the seashore has a lot of seasonal employees. The seashore staff would not speak with me directly. They're really not allowed to by the federal government. But I talked with David Bernstein, who is the board president of the Friends Group, the Friends of the Cape Cod National Seashore. He says about two-thirds of the total staff are seasonal there, and the seashore hires between 100 and 110 people for the summer usually. Those folks do a lot of important things. They are lifeguards, for one. They are rangers. Bernstein says the summer rangers do many of the talks that take place at the visitor center, and they do all sorts of other things. They are cleaners, cleaning the bathrooms, doing maintenance, driving the beach shuttles, public safety, so many things. There are at least partly seasonal. The seashore staff did refer me to the National Park Service, and I got a written response from the Park Service about this. The spokesperson there says that they will be hiring for, quote, key positions, unquote, at the parks, but that person would not answer any questions about what types of positions those would be. And we have seen some reporting nationally about this, that job offers have been rescinded summer job offers at the parks in some cases. The Washington Post reported about 400 seasonal jobs at national parks have been rescinded.
The seashore, obviously, is such a big economic draw for the Cape in the summer. Are people concerned about that, about the implications here?
Yes, definitely. If the experience in the park is much different, people are concerned about that. I mean, the beaches themselves are generally not shut down for lack of staff. But if there's a cut in lifeguards and amenities, that could definitely reduce the number of people who want to go and spend their summer vacation there. I talked with the CEO of the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce, Paul Nedzwicki, and he said he believes a big reduction in staff would have a significant effect on the Cape. According to the Friends Group, the National Seashore brings about 4 million people to Cape Cod each year, and it brings in almost $540 million to the local economy.
How about other national parks? What about the Whaling National Historical Park in New Bedford?
That is a good question, but the New Bedford Park does not hire seasonal workers. So this summer issue does not affect them. Although definitely if the broader hiring freeze in the federal government continues and they have openings they can't fill, then that could affect them, but not for seasonal workers. In New Bedford, the tours they give there in the historic area are run by the year-round staff and by volunteers.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
Cape Cod residents and public officials are urging Governor Healey to reverse a decision that would shut down one of the only inpatient mental health facilities on Cape Cod. CAI's Eve Zuckoff spoke with those who are advocating for the Pocasset Mental Health Center this week. She joins us now. She's been here listening along. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
This week, more than 150 people gathered in Pocasset to talk with lawmakers about why this facility matters so much. Before we talk about what you heard there, explain some of the background here. If you haven't been following along, what's going on here with the Pocasset Mental Health Center?
Sure. So this story really begins last month with Governor Mara Healey proposing her 2026 fiscal budget. And it includes plans to close the Pocasset Mental Health Center, which is a 16-bed inpatient facility. It also includes plans to run another state-run facility in Canton. Healey also included plans in there to cut the mental health case manager workforce by about half. She said at kind of various points that Pocasset, this health center there, has a low utilization rate, and members of her administration have assured families that they are taking steps to improve the care and services that they're able to offer.
If this center does go away, if it's shut down for budget reasons, what happens to that need in the community?
Well, there is still an inpatient place in Hyannis, but that has to serve this entire region, including the islands. If people want to stay close to their loved ones, which of course they do, who are suffering from a mental health crisis. Advocates say that, what we have now isn't enough as is. So without Pocasset, there will be less than 24 inpatient mental health beds to serve this entire region, which means more people with mental health crises will be waiting in hospital emergency departments or they can do that for weeks at a time. Lots of families will be driving 2 to 3 hours to visit their loved ones, which is incredibly disruptive and sometimes impossible.
At this event this week, I know you heard personal stories. Among those who spoke are people who have relied on the Pocasset facility. Give us a sense of the personal testimony that you heard at this meeting.
Yeah, I mean, we heard from family members, nurses, caseworkers, patients themselves. They were all offering testimonies about how Pocasset has saved lives. Like, I talked with one family, this man named Cliff Calderwood, said that the Pocasset Mental Health Center treated his son in 2017 when he was struggling to stay on medication for his schizophrenia. He came out of Pocasset and has stayed on meds ever since. He manages his own meds. He has a job. He drives his own car. He owns his own car, his mom was quick to tell me. A former patient who said her name was Danielle said that she spent 50 days in the facility. That's another kind of important thing to mention. A lot of these facilities are much more short term. In this, lots of folks stay 40, 50 days. She said that she wouldn't have been standing there this week without her time in Pocasset, where staff taught her and everyone else things. She felt really respected there. And speaking of staff, one more person to mention, Jean Calvert McClure, a social worker for the Department of Mental Health, described this closure as a disaster. Mm. She said, "We're going to see an increase in suicides. We're going to see an increase in domestic violence and all the other public health emergencies that can be connected to these kinds of crises."
There were also policymakers at this event, people who can carry this message back up to Beacon Hill. Tell us who was there and how did they react hearing these stories from the audience?
Yeah, it was a real who's who. There was State Senator Dylan Fernandez, who's Democrat, State Representative David Vieira, who's a Republican. So there's a good bipartisan mix. I saw Julian Sear. I saw members of the Bourne Select Board, representatives from Falmouth. And the folks who will go back to Beacon Hill say that they are prioritizing this. That is part of why this meeting happened, so that these policymakers can go back to their colleagues and say, look at this. Look at all of the support I'm hearing from my constituents. And one other person who was really interesting, who was in attendance, was Barnstable County Sheriff Donna Buckley, who said that, you know, she knows there are people in our jails who are committing crimes, but are committing crimes because they're in crisis. And to close this facility is to criminalize mental health, because we don't have enough appropriate early intervention and stabilization and case management services as is.
The outcome is uncertain here, but what comes next? What's happening next for this?
Well, advocates are asking people to sign a petition. There are more than 2,000 signatures on change.org this morning. There's also going to be a rally today at the Bourne Rotary later this afternoon. But all of this, that's kind of on the public-facing support side. All of it is to help our state house representatives bolster a case for a budget amendment. Because, look, the governor gets to put out her budget, but then the House and the Senate get to weigh in. So our representatives say they will be doing that, and they want to keep hearing from people who say that the Pocasset Mental Health Center matters.
Okay, I want to talk about another story you reported this week. Today is Valentine's Day. You discovered Barnstable couples therapist who is trying to set singles up on dates for a new reality TV dating show. Tell us about this story.
Yeah, this is the Who Could Love Them project. I talked with Felicia Romano, who grew up on the Cape, is a couples therapist now. She basically told me this all came together because she loves reality TV and she loves her single friends. And she figured that she could use her skills and she describes it as invasive nature to become a matchmaker. So she kind of had this idea, put out a Google form asking people, you know, telling people like, I'm doing this, send me information about yourselves. And she already has 100 people who have signed up, aged 20 to 72. They've all filled out their forms, and she's starting to learn things about people's preferences, like why they won't date a Pisces. I would love to be going through the forms with her.
So this is still early going because she's trying to set people up to get filmed. Is that what happens next?
Yeah, and people are saying yes to it, which she was nervous at first that people maybe wouldn't want that piece of it. They would want to be match made, but not filmed while doing it. But no, she's going to be filming it. Ideally, once kind of the recruitment period ends on February 28th, she's going to interview people at the Cape Media Center on camera, and then she'll begin matching people up, like putting these puzzle pieces together, sending people out on dates. She's looking for businesses on the Cape who might be open to hosting some of those. If she can't do that, she will set up like a mock date set at the Cape Media Center. Although I told her I would give a plug here. She does need more straight men over 50. So if that is you and you're listening to this on Valentine's Day, maybe give her a shout over at whocouldlovethem@gmail.com.
Okay, one last thing, just a minute here. We should give listeners a heads up that next week we'll be releasing a special collaborative story with the Martha's Vineyard Times. It's all about the rising cost of home insurance on the island. You've been working hard on this. Just briefly, tell us what folks could expect.
Yeah, so on Wednesday, we will release stories that come from this Martha's Vineyard Times collaboration. The stories will be on air, online, in the paper, on social media, in your inbox. We're kind of going wall to wall here because the Times got 300 responses to a question about how the cost of home insurance on the island has changed. They were blown away by some of the responses, pulled us into the project. And since then, me and another reporter, we've interviewed more than a half dozen people about their personal stories of home insurance. This is the project that has been keeping me up at night, hearing what people are sacrificing in order to pay for their exorbitant home insurance costs. It's a story that's only going to get worse with climate change. I hope people read it because it's a harbinger. It's a warning of what's to come.
That is CAI's Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thank you.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. We'll take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak to Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on CAI. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Martha's Vineyard, New York. Could there ever be such a place? Well, in fact, the island once belonged to that distant imperious state. If you don't believe it, Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette is here with the story. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning, Steve.
I'll admit it, this is more of a history piece than breaking news, but to me, it was news, Ethan. How did you find out about this?
Yeah, I mean, it starts as all good stories start, as a late-night Wikipedia session.
Explain here what's going on. This relates to the history of the island in the colonial time, or, you know, very early in the European history of the island, in which it belonged to the state of New York, not to Massachusetts, even though we're right off the coast.
Yeah, so like you said, this is in the early 1600s. Martha's Vineyard belonged to the Massachusetts Bay Colony. That's a lot of people who know any kind of Massachusetts history will have heard of them. But in around kind of in the middle of the century, there are changes over in England with the king. He gave his brother, the Duke of York, New York, New Jersey, and all the islands east of Long Island. So that included us and Nantucket. So we kind of shifted over to our enemies on the baseball diamond, but it didn't mean a whole lot to people here on the vineyard, at least initially.
We'll talk about what the vineyard was like at that time, how many people were there, and there was kind of one, we can say, like a ruling family.
Yeah, so obviously the Wampanoag people were here already, and then we had about 40 settler families, and kind of the big family and the big name that people will know is the Mayhew family, Thomas Mayhew, who would eventually be named the governor for life of Martha's Vineyard, or really, I think, our only governor ever here. His family basically had, kind of for lack of a better word, an aristocracy. Every official was either a family member or someone appointed by them, and everyone kind of had to answer to them.
I think that one thing I'm struck by in this article that you've put together here is how many of the names are actually kind of familiar names to people who are familiar with the vineyard today.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the families didn't like basically being under an aristocracy. So there's one Simon Athern, who is a rabble-rouser, and if you come to the island, the Athern name is very prominent still, and if you've ever been to Morning Glory Farm, there's a Simon Athern who still works there. It's definitely kind of, it's very old history, but very new history. If you go past the airport here on the vineyard, there's a plaque commemorating Thomas Mayhew Sr.'s son, who was, I believe he was a missionary out here. It's old, but it's new at the same time, kind of.
So there was this period during the 1600s when the island was essentially under rule of New York, even though New York State was far enough away that really it was fairly independent, the island. And that was part of the draw for having that set up for the people who were living there, because they actually didn't want that much oversight, it sounds like.
Yeah, if you were in charge of Martha's Vineyard, as the Mayhews were, they liked New York. They loved it, actually. There was you have a distant government over there who has basically no oversight and much bigger problems to deal with than 40 farming families on this little island. So there was a push at one point by Simon Athern and others on the island to come back to Massachusetts. They said that we really like kind of the democratic tendencies of Massachusetts and the proximity to the mainland there. So that became kind of a struggle throughout this period.
One of the lasting implications here is in the naming of the Dukes County, which I didn't realize is actually a holdover from when the island was held by New York State.
Yeah. People probably recognize some of the so-called royal counties of New York. There was Kings County, Queens County, Dutchess County, and then Dukes County, which was us. And, you know, we broke off from back to Massachusetts, but then we still have this weird name convention for anyone who comes to the island. If you go past the courthouse or some government buildings, it says the County of Dukes County, which is redundant and weird, but it's kind of a holdover from the old Massachusetts way of naming counties is the County of X, insert the name. but our name was Dukes County, so it became the County of Dukes County.
And of course, back then, I should say, it wasn't New York State, it was the colony of New York. Wampanoag history should not be lost in all this. The Wampanoag were here long before any of this squabbling about what supposedly belonged to whom. Nobody consulted the Wampanoag here.
No, I mean, at the original time, they bought, quote-unquote, land from the Wampanoag, and that sense of purchasing didn't really exist before the settlers got here. And their numbers declined dramatically during that time here on the island. I believe it got down to about a third by the 1700s. It seemed there was some initial okay relations between the two, just because all of the settlers had set up camp in Edgartown. But yeah, obviously it didn't work out great for the Wampanoag people during this time period.
And no movement on the island now to return to New York rule.
We've tried to secede from Massachusetts in general, but we didn't look to New York as our savior, no.
Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette, where you can read the story. It's a lot of great history there. Thanks, Ethan.
Thanks, Steve.
A program that seeks to support school students, supporting the well-being of their peers, got a big boost recently. It's called Hope Squad. Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle has details and joins us. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, Steve.
Hope Squad is kind of the final embodiment of a long train of effort here. But start with that. Explain the Hope Squad model for us.
Yeah, so Hope Squad is a program that, you know, here in the Cape is sort of promoted through a nonprofit based in Harwich called Sharing Kindness. And the idea is schools that adopt the Hope Squad program, they train, a faculty advisor and as well as students that are recommended for the program on really how to advocate for their peers, kind of social and emotional wellness, their mental health. And to really pick up, you know, indicators or signs that something might be wrong with a student and really what to do with that, you know, how to, put them in contact with the people or the resources they need. This is a program that is currently in 12 schools across the Cape, 10 high schools and 2 middle schools. And it's really, again, just focused on kind of mindfulness around the issues of social and emotional health, which, you know, as we keep hearing more and more about the importance of that, especially at the school level.
As I understand it, Hope Squad is an effort by a group called Sharing Kindness. It's a Harwich-based nonprofit that helps to train the students and the faculty advisors here. And they recently received a grant to continue this work and kind of expand it from the Cape and Islands District Attorney's Office. Tell us what happened here.
Yeah, that's right. So last week, Cape and Islands District Attorney Rob Delvoits made a presentation of $48,000 approximately to Sharing Kindness. It was the largest portion of the overall $129,000 that the office is sort of making available in the way of grants to address issues of suicide prevention awareness and gun safety. But for Sharing Kindness, this $48,000 is going to be used primarily to expand Hope Squad into more schools. Dr. Kim Mead Walters, who founded Sharing Kindness with her husband Davis, said she would particularly like to see, you know, this program get into more middle schools, citing that, you know, this is a particular issue that is affecting students in the 10 to 14 age range, particularly girls of color. So this funding, her words, this is kind of a game changer and really a huge boost for the program as they try to kind of expand it across the Cape and Islands.
Across the Lower Cape, it's been a couple of weeks of some generous giving. I know the Chatham Historical Society is one of 3 nonprofits in the region to receive a generous gift from a local family. Give us a brief overview of what's happened there.
Yeah, so the estates of Jan and Louise Nickerson last week granted $1 million to three different nonprofit organizations, including the Chatham Historical Society, the Nickerson Family Association, and the Edward Bangs Kelly and Elza Kelly Foundation. Again, each of those organizations has sort of been bequeathed $1 million each, which, you know, as I'm sure I need to tell you, for a local nonprofit, $1 million donation is kind of, pretty unprecedented. I think that was actually the word used by one of the organizers of the three groups. But not short money, especially in this climate where there's a lot more uncertainty or, you know, what may or may not be available.
That is Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
All right, Steve, thanks.
In Wellfleet, a house on a precipitous bluff is poised to tumble into the ocean. It's been getting a lot of attention in the news in the last couple of weeks, in part because it is quite a jarring sight. But folks on the Outer Cape have been following the saga of its predicament for years now. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent joins us with some new details. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Steve. It really is a saga.
It is. I guess people might be familiar with this as the Blash House after its former owners. Its current owner has said he's done with this house. He said it's up to the town to figure out what to do with it. And this is a big, kind of like a relatively new house. This is not an old Cape Cod cottage.
No, the house that's there right now was actually built in 2010. By Mark and Barbara Blash, as you noted. It was controversial, very controversial at the time. It's over 5,000 square feet, which was very much larger than the little house that preceded it in that spot. But at the time, Wellfleet's zoning laws did not actually prohibit that, and the construction of this house actually prompted a change in Wellfleet's zoning to try and prevent such things from happening in the future. But it went up and right on close to the edge of the bluff overlooking Cape Cod Bay. This is in a very prominent spot at what's called the Gut, right at the entrance to Great Island in the Cape Cod National Seashore.
The bluff on which it's sitting has been eaten away by erosion now, and so the house itself is perched right up against the edge. It looks like it could come down with one or two more big storms, and the owner has said that because he's not permitted to put a stone revetment down below to shore up that bluff, it's not he's going to kind of walk away from the responsibility of the house. Is that right? That seems like a painful thing for the town to try to figure out.
That's exactly right. The current owner, John G. Bonomi of New York, his lawyer, Thomas C. Moore, told the Conservation Commission last month that he was basically washing his hands of it and walking away from it. The lawyer told the Conservation Commission in a letter that Bonomi had actually conveyed the title of the house to a company, CQN Salvage, whom Moore, the lawyer, also represented. It's really not clear that that's true. There's no record of such a transfer at the Barnstable County Registry of Deeds. People in Wellfleet are skeptical about that whole thing. Sheila Lyons, who's a member of the Wellfleet Select Board and also a county commissioner, says it seems to me like his lawyer just set up this shell company in order to be able to just walk away from it. So the town is considering legal action. They're having an executive session with town council and the conservation department to see what they can do. But it's really not clear that the town can get anything to happen to force the owner to remove the house, which is what needs to happen, before it actually falls in. Mark Borelli, who's a coastal geologist at the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown, says it's only a matter of time. But it won't be long, and it could be this winter. One big storm could knock that house right into Cape Cod Bay.
And the implications there aren't just a whole bunch of housing material going into the bay. It could get swept around into Wellfleet Harbor.
Well, that's exactly right. People who study the currents out there say that the debris from the house, including toxic materials, would be swept right around the point into Wellfleet Harbor and threaten to contaminate the shellfish beds there. And so the shellfish community, including Shellfish Constable Nancy Chivetta, who points out that about 10% of the town's population is supported by the shellfishing industry here, they are very concerned about this. And there's other ecological problems that would happen from having all that stuff in the water, too.
And this is kind of one note that the article ends on here, is that this is not the only house that this is in this predicament.
Well, right. Sheila Ryans pointed this out to our reporter, Christine Legere, that there's many other houses, especially over on the ocean side, that are in similar situations. And Ryans said, that's all the more reason that we really have to fight this. Everybody will walk away from these things if we don't enforce that responsibility.
Mm. That is Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. Ed, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
You are listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with the journalists who cover them. Nantucket is moving quickly to address PFAS contamination found in one of the public drinking water supply wells. Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current has the story and joins us. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
The town is declaring a public emergency to address this issue, but that sounds like it's also a bit of a procedural move, that designation.
It is, and it obviously sounds very concerning and certainly is when we're talking about public drinking water. But this is a situation that the town has been aware of and planning for months now. And the well, the public drinking water well that is affected, has been actually turned off since 2022, when there was a slight uptick in PFAS detected at that well. It's since gone up to a point where they don't want to turn it on, and they want to invest in a treatment system that will allow the well to come back online, treat it for PFAS, which, as we know, is the forever chemicals that are in just about everything and can cause some serious health problems. And many towns across the state and country are dealing with this in various ways. But for the sole source aquifer of Nantucket, this source of the PFAS contamination is not yet known exactly what's causing this. They do know where it is, and obviously it being close to the public drinking water well, they want to move quickly to address this. So the state declaration of a state of emergency is really to streamline the funding to acquire the treatment system, and, you know, so they can sort of skip some of the steps within procurement and other things that, you know, could make it take longer than it needs to.
I guess the public drinking water supply on the island is supplied by seven different wells. This is one of those seven. Is that right?
Correct. So it's seven different wells around the island that supply public water. This has been turned off since 2022. Testing for PFAS on the rest of the wells indicates that there is no detection of the chemicals from the other wells. So they're confident that the town's water right now is clean. There is some concern, though, that without this well, regarding water pressure, if there was a large fire like the one we saw downtown several years ago at the Veranda House, that they would need this additional well to be able to pump enough water to cover the fire department in the event of a large fire. So they are moving with some urgency to address this and get a treatment system in place before summer.
Let me ask you about another story you've got. The Steamship Authority is getting one of its new freight boats into action. You've got a profile of what seems like a number of recent glitches that this boat has run into. The boat is the freight boat, the Barnstable.
Right. And this is the, one of the three, the first of the three offshore supply vessels that had previously been working in the oil and gas industry along the Gulf Coast that the steamship acquired and has been retrofitted. And this was the first one to make the trip north from Alabama, where they're being retrofitted to come up and go into service on the Nantucket route. Now, that initial trip was delayed after a series of problems was discovered with this vessel. So the first being, you know, that it missed its first trip due to a reduction gear lube oil cooler. Okay. So this is all the stuff that the general manager was going over, during the port council meeting earlier this week. That discovery led to the, them finding out that they need a block heater for the engine as it's operating in temperatures, much colder temperatures than it had been in the Gulf. But a series of, other issues have cropped up. Since they've started making those first trips to Nantucket, it wasn't going fast enough. They weren't able to load the trucks as they expected. The draft was actually too large under the really heavy freight loads that it was taking over first thing in the morning. So the steamship is working through these. They think they all can be addressed. They've already made several tweaks to address some of them in terms of the speed and the draft. Working with the naval engineers and the Coast Guard to address them, but they describe them as a number of bugs that is sort of normal when you bring a new boat online. You're going to have to work through the tweaks, but obviously not what the steamship had hoped with these new freight boats.
Yeah, and there's some sympathy about they have to work through these problems in public. I mean, they have to get this boat up and running to even to figure out what some of those issues are, and then they work through them. One of the interesting things, like the issue about the block heater you were saying, is because these boats have actually only been operated in warmer climates. They've never been operated up here in New England.
Right. So that's one thing that, you know, has already been addressed and already fixed, that block heater for the engine. But something that, you know, they are going to work and make sure that the other two that are still down in Alabama getting retrofitted are hopefully going to have all these tweaks so they can sort of seamlessly come in based on the experience that they're going through with the Barnstable.
Can you talk just a little bit about the loading? This I thought was interesting, that they found out that, I guess, when they load the boat to send it across the island first thing in the morning, that it's sinking too far down. It's getting it's carrying too much weight. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. So they realized that the draft was too large, especially on the morning, first trip in the morning when they're loading, you know, it's called the hazmat trip. They've got gasoline, a number of large trucks. So what Bob Davis, who's the general manager, said is, you know, they get somewhere between 650,000 to 700,000 pounds of weight on board. The stern ends up being over 10 feet of draft. So it puts them into a different operating parameter, and they can't load the number of trucks that they need to go over. So right now they're working with Naval Architect on how to adjust the ballast system to be able to account for that. They think it's fixable. They're waiting on a stability letter from the Coast Guard that would allow them to carry the intended cargo weight.
It's Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current. Jason, thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
President Trump's asserted plan to deport undocumented immigrants in numbers is having a big impact on the South Coast. And now the Portuguese government is preparing for an influx of returnees from the United States. Kevin G. Andrade of the New Bedford Light has the story and joins us right now. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for having me on.
You looked in your article specifically at the Azorean population. For people who may not be familiar with the distinctions, explain this a little bit. The Azores are a set of small islands, part of Portugal, but they have their own significant connection to our region.
Yes. So Portugal is a much more centralized government than the United States, and there are two autonomous regions. One is an archipelago off the coast of Africa called Madeira, and the other is a group of nine islands in the middle of the Atlantic called the Açores. And there's about 250,000 people who live there now. And going back to the 19th century, back when New Bedford was the international center of whaling, whaling ships used to stop in the area and recrew, resupply, and go on their journey. Then once they returned to New Bedford, many of them would stay. And that's where the community got its roots. And in fact, the majority of Portuguese in the area do consider themselves of Azorean descent.
So talk a little bit about what's happening now. It seems as though there's a large portion, or there's a portion of the community, I guess I should say, who are looking at returning to the Azores, perhaps in light of what's happening in Washington.
Yes. So according to Elena da Silva Hughes, who's the president of the Immigrants Assistance Center, she's an immigrant herself from Madeira. There's about 1,000 families who have undocumented people within them of Portuguese descent, largely of Azorean descent, who might end up having to leave. Many of the people who came here over the last 20 years or so are visa overstays. The Azores are the poorest region in Portugal. There's not a lot of economic opportunity over there. Many of them, because of those historical connections I referenced earlier, have much deeper family connections to this area than they might to the continent or the Lisbon area. So as a result, they come here, visit family, visit friends, find they like it, overstay a tourist visa, get jobs, get married, start families. And now, with President Trump's rhetoric and apparent actions regarding deportations, they're scared, they're selling their properties, and they're getting ready to move back. Many of them are saying, I don't even want to risk being detained. I'm just going to pack up my things and go. And the Azorean government's already noted that that's starting to happen.
One of the things that you point to that's interesting here is that there's some historical precedent for this, the kind of the wave that goes back and forth.
Yeah. So way back in the 90s and 2000s, there were several thousand deportees sent to Portugal, and it was the result of a convergence of local politics and federal politics. At the federal level, you had the passage of the 1996 Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, which created a category which made aggravated felonies retroactive, meaning a person could be deported for a crime they committed decades prior. So as a result, you had many people who were green card holders who got mixed in with drugs, committed some sort of felony act as a result, and then got flagged for removal. They entered into removal proceedings and were forced back. This created a big social crisis on the islands. The other factor in this is local. You had Paul Weld, who was the Bristol County District Attorney at the time, and Thomas Hodgson, who became Bristol County Sheriff in 1997. They were both going after federal funds related to immigration enforcement. In fact, in 2007, Sheriff Hodgson created the C. Carlos Carreiro Immigration Detention Center in Dartmouth, which resulted in an ICE contract bringing more money in. Just simply due to the fact that there is such a strong concentration of Portuguese Americans and Portuguese immigrants in Bristol County, they ended up being sent back. They ended up being deported in numbers large proportional to the population.
It's a fascinating series that you've put together here in the New Bedford Light. There's a lot of reporting here. It's worth noting that a fifth of New Bedford's over 100,000 residents were foreign-born, according to the 2023 American Community Service or Survey one-year estimate. It's a huge number and a big impact on the community on the South Coast. Kevin G. Andrade reporting there for the New Bedford Light. Kevin, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Steve.
It's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. We spoke with Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette and Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Ed Miller, the Provincetown Independent, and Jason Grazire of Nantucket Current, and Kevin G. Andrade there from the New Bedford Light. Thanks to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. He is the deep keel that keeps the ship running straight and smooth. That's all we've got in Woods Hole. I'm Steve Junker. I'll be out next week. Talk to you in 2 weeks.